What's your feeling about what happened September 11th in New York City and Washington, D.C. with the terrorist attacks against the World Trade Center and the Pentagon? I know there's a rumor in a lot of Arab countries that this is all a setup to justify U.S. foreign policy in the world because this gives so much more power to U.S. government worldwide. How do you view these attacks, and do you think that the CIA was aware that these were going to happen, and what's your view on it?
Well, since those events, the U.S. government has exploited greatly in many, many ways. They have taken advantage of what happened to pass laws to help the corporations to go after people they want. Well, I mean, it's a long, long list of things that the U.S. has done since then. They're now getting favorable treatment from Congress for a missile defense program, and appointments are being pushed through Congress much quicker. I mean, all kinds of ways. So much so that one can, you know, if one asks the classic question, who benefits? You know, one could point a finger at the U.S., but I would not say therefore that they were behind these attacks. I think what is much more likely is that the CIA and the FBI and so on, they had good information that something big was about to happen, not knowing exactly the exact day or the exact target, but they knew something big was happening, and they let it proceed. They allowed the plans to proceed, to observe it. And partly, I think, because they know they benefit from such things. The U.S. needs enemies to pursue their policies, to have their fantastic budgets for the FBI and for the Pentagon. They need enemies, and in the bombing in Oklahoma City in 1995, there's even more evidence that the FBI had good reason to expect something of that nature was about to happen. They had informers amongst the militia people who were associated with McVeigh, and in the 1993 bombing of the World Trade Center in New York, the FBI had an informer, and he was a provocateur. He helped to push the people who were convicted of it, of the act. He helped to push them along. So these agencies are not so innocent. But I think in speaking of September 11th, I'm more suspicious of the role of the Israeli Mossad than I am of the CIA. Israel had a great deal to benefit from it because they wanted the world. In fact, there were reports of how happy the people in Israel were at this. They were not upset. They said, now the world will see what we have to deal with the Palestinians. They said that explicitly. And as it turns out, there's a big question about how many Israelis were killed in the World Trade Center. Most countries, or many of them, suffered hundreds of casualties in that building. Israel says there were only two or three Israelis who died in the explosion, which is very odd. Now, which seems to lend some credence to the rumors that Israel had informed the Israeli employees in those buildings to take the day off. That's the rumor being passed around, and I cannot say it's anything more than a rumor. But I spoke to the Israeli embassy in Washington, and they confirmed that only three people from Israel died in that blast.
And do they know how many employees worked there?
I asked them that. The woman I spoke to said she didn't know, which is surprising. Other countries seem to have known exactly how many people were working there. The rumor says that there were 4,000 Israelis working there, which seems awfully high. I doubt that figure, but probably was in the hundreds. And if only three died, that makes me wonder.
We've been speaking with William Blum, author of the book Killing Hope, U.S. Military and CIA Interventions Since World War II, published by Common Courage Press. I know one thing that's interesting about this is there's a lot of people saying that acts of terrorism have to be punished, whatever the reasons. And on the site of Z Magazine, on the webpage, Michael Albert asked the questions, why do they hate us? And he gives a whole list of reasons. Do you really believe that there's enough hatred in the Arab world towards U.S. foreign policy that some people would feel compelled to act in the way they did or the way they do act?
Yeah, in my book I give a long list of the acts of U.S. foreign policy against the Middle East in the past 20 years. It's a very long list, and there's certainly more than enough reason there. But I must point out that the U.S. government in its foreign policy has hurt Latin America even more than the Middle East. And if people in Latin America had the same belief as Muslims do, that by martyring themselves, killing the great Satan, they would go to instant paradise. If they had held that belief, I think we would have had by now decades of terrorism coming from south of the border. But it's been the Middle East mainly. And they have more than enough reason to do what they do. But, you know, you're speaking about the question about why do they hate us. This is not simply a question of the left wing. The media here, to my surprise and pleasure, has been moved to take up that question. They are so shocked by what happened, as they should be, as we all are, that they have been driven to find an answer to that question. And I have read story after story in the daily press and heard on the mainstream media, on the radio, this question discussed at length. I have read articles in Time magazine and USA Today and the Washington Post and other places, which I never thought I would see in print. And I've heard National Public Radio spend a whole hour with Michael Albert, in fact, whose name you just mentioned, discussing these questions. It's an amazing phenomenon, and I have to wonder how long it'll last, or whether it'll survive the end of the current crisis.
And in the States right now, you're talking about listening to media, public radio, and watching television and such. It seems like a lot of the media is caught up in anthrax, and a lot of issues around anthrax. And so I'm wondering, what has been the use of anthrax in U.S. and military and CIA intervention, and where do you see this going domestically?
The U.S. government has, as far as I know, has never used anthrax. They have engaged in chemical and biological warfare, though, against Cuba on several occasions and against other countries. But the use of anthrax per se, I'm not aware of. They did indirectly spread that weapon. They gave Saddam Hussein in the 1980s, while Iraq was fighting Iran in an 8-year war, the U.S. gave Saddam Hussein a whole large supply of many kinds of biological materials which can be used for weaponry, including the anthrax bacillus and E. coli and a bunch of other things. And as it turns out, Saddam used some of these weapons against his own people and against Iran. So the U.S. is indirectly responsible for that kind of chemical and biological warfare.
All right.
As far as the current crisis is concerned, now I don't know who's behind this. I'm beginning to suspect it may be militia types, because they are turning so much of their attention to abortion clinics. It makes me wonder about them.
You say they're turning their attention to abortion clinics. What do you mean by that?
They're sending abortion clinics all over the country are receiving letters with powder in them and threats, so far the powders have turned out to be hoaxes.
Yeah, because right now the media is focusing on Ted or the NBC News Tom Brokaw and
right. It's been the media mainly.
Yeah,
but this I've had to choose between, as suspects, between the militias and the terrorists from the Middle East, I would choose the militias. Terrorists wouldn't be bothering with such petty stuff. I mean, one person here, one person there. The object of using such a weapon would be to spur it in the air in a crowded place and infect many people at one time, if you're a serious terrorist. But what we have now is just harassment, and that's not quite the same thing.
All right, William Blum, unfortunately, that's all the time we have for this morning. I'd like to thank you very much for being with us. It's been really great having you on the air.
Thank you. Could I mention my email address if people want further
information about my book?
Go
right ahead.
It's a bblum6@aol.com.
And it's a really excellent book, Killing Hope, U.S. Military and CIA Intervention Since World War II. It's an encyclopedia of terror that the United States has enacted worldwide. So do check it out if you want context and background to U.S. foreign policy, which is war and violence.
All right, William Blum, thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
That was William Blum, author of Killing Hope, U.S. Military Interventions in the CIA Since World War II. Thanks to Jean-Francois and Gretchen King at CKUT in Montreal for that tape. Our last segment of the program tonight will deal with the rise of corporate power in the United States and its destruction of democratic processes. First, though, some community announcements and issues. This coming Monday, November 12th, Kevin Danaher from Global Exchange will speak at Wells College. The talk begins at 8 o'clock p.m. and will be held at the Wells College Chapel, which seats only 200, so come early. Wells College is located on Highway 89 in the village of Aurora. Luke Anderson, the anti-GMO foods activist from the UK, will be speaking in Ithaca on Tuesday, November 13th, at 7:30 p.m. He will speak at the Women's Community Building, which is located at 100 West Seneca Street in Ithaca. The ramming of the Geneva Ag Biotech Park down the collective throats of Finger Lakes residents, the research and development of biotechnology at Cornell, and the 209 test sites and 101 field releases in New York State make this a crucial and timely talk. And the latest development in the campaign to stop gas drilling in the Finger Lakes National Forest is that Congress has failed thus far to pass legislation banning drilling permanently. A one-year temporary ban on drilling has been granted, giving us another year to fight to save the forest and the surrounding area from destruction. The Finger Lakes Forest Watch Congress will be meeting to come to a consensus on how to proceed. If you'd like to get involved in saving the forest, or for more information, visit their website at www.flfwc.org. That's www.flfwc.org, or call Jesse Strock at area code 607-220-4222. That's area code 607-220-4222. You're tuned to Unwelcome Guests on WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, or WXXC Truxton. CLAD, the Project on Corporations, Law, and Democracy, is an organization devoted to expanding avenues to reclaim self-governance in America from corporate domination. Four members of POCLAD, Ward Morehouse, Karen Coulter, Jane Ann Morris, and Richard Grossman, spoke at the University of Washington last month. The first speaker you'll hear is Ward Morehouse.
We're delighted to be here. I am particularly pleased to be here because the last time I was in Seattle, which was in March of 2000, I spent most of my time in the King County Courthouse. Ultimately, the judge did the right thing and threw out the charges against us, but only after a lot of travail and a couple of days of testimony during which the cops perjured themselves, hopelessly indeed. What we were arrested for, Sherry Hankla of the Kensington Welfare Rights Union in Philadelphia and myself, was attempting to serve citizen arrest warrants on the G7 trade ministers for their complicity in corporate crimes against humanity. We thought this was a pretty plausible proposition. The cops had a different view. Anyway, I've not even been near the King County Courthouse on this visit, and this is a much more congenial environment, I assure you. I want to say a little bit about POCLAD, Program on Corporations, Law, and Democracy, before we get underway with matters of real significance and substance. The Program on Corporations, Law, and Democracy is a strange animal. It's nothing like Greenpeace or the Sierra Club or almost any other organized effort to change the world, however small a portion of it may be in that organization's focus. We have more modest objectives. We want to establish a truly effective democratic society within the United States, understanding that at present we live in a very different kind of environment. It's not democratic at all, as all of us in this room know. It is, in fact, a plutocracy, a government by the rich. Yet the principle on which this country was founded was self-government. So this is our modest goal, is to try to achieve real self-governance in the United States. We do this through a variety of means. We number 12 of us who live and work in different places across North America and who come together periodically to trade ideas, to compare notes, to engage in collective efforts of one kind or another, all broadly directed toward instigating democratic conversations and actions that challenge those in positions of established authority. In short, we've tried to raise a little bit of hell, and we feel we're in good company with the groups that have sponsored this gathering this evening. I want also to say that we've come to town as part of what we call our Defying Corporations, Defining Democracy tour. Seattle is the first stop on that tour, and we've come here to try to stimulate interest in some of the our recent literary efforts, of which the most substantial is a book entitled, appropriately enough, Defying Corporations, Defining Democracy. And Pete Seeger had this to say about us and our work. He said, the first step in solving a problem is learning more about the problem and how and why it grew. POCLAD is giving us U.S. history like it's never taught in schools. Hooray! So we say hooray back to Pete Seeger and invite you all to get a copy of the book after the program this evening. George Braffin is sitting up there. George, identify yourself if you would. And he has a bundle of copies. We don't want to lug those all the way back to the East Coast, so please come forward. And I think they're offered on a concessional price at $15 bucks rather than $18 or whatever it is. We also have a flyer which describes some of our other publications and productions. which are also back there, including a very important one on an entirely different approach, a constitutionally based approach to labor organizing, entitled Building Unions by our colleague Peter Kelman. Just a word about what I think is, at least to me, is the dead squirrel that's on the couch at the cocktail party. No one wants to say anything about it, but everyone knows it's there. And that's, of course, the very tragic events that are now taking place in the other side of the globe, the aggression by our government, albeit with provocation. It's a very sad moment in our history, I think, for all of us. Sad both because of the terrible loss of innocent life on the 11th of September, but sad also because we have once again resorted to violence that can only result in other innocent people losing their lives and their livelihood. Awful as the events on the 11th of September were, on the scale of human carnage, it was not nearly as bad as some other events in recent decades. One with which I'm particularly engaged is the world's worst industrial disaster, which took place in Bhopal in India in December of 1984. The loss of life in the Bhopal disaster, which was perpetrated by the Union Carbide Corporation, a U.S.-based corporation, was greater than it was in New York and Washington on the 11th of September. The number of injured was far, far greater, close to 500,000 innocent people. So there are, I fear, sadly, in a way, links between what's going on at this moment as we are gathered here in and over Afghanistan, yet these have links to corporate power and to institutions that sustain that power. We are, of course, also aware that the groundwork is being laid for repression of dissenting voices. I think this is almost inevitable. If you need only read Ashcroft's testimony before the Senate Judiciary Committee on the new anti-terrorism legislation to get some idea of what lies ahead. And I think it reflects, unfortunately, a hysterical mood of the moment. And I think one of the most engaging characterizations of that hysteria comes from Reverend Jerry Falwell, and I'd like to read it to you. He says, "I really believe that the pagans and the abortionists and the feminists and the gays and the lesbians who are actively trying to make an alternative lifestyle, the ACLU, People for the American Way, all of them who have tried to secularize America, I point the finger in their face and say, you helped this happen." Well, frankly, I'm offended that he didn't mention Poklab. And I think he should have mentioned the Student Action Network and the Democracy and Globalization Working Group, and no doubt a dozen other groups. But that's the environment in which we now find ourselves. And so with that, by way of introduction, I turn to Karen, you're next, to Karen Coulter, who comes to us from Eastern Oregon, where she's the moving spirit behind the Blue Mountains Biodiversity Project. She's in the front line of the struggle to save the forests of the Pacific Northwest. She's also an active worker in Poklab.
I'd like to start with a question, which is leading off where Ward left off. What makes terrorist attacks acts of terrorism? Well, the victims, the people affected, we're not the ones determining the policies that caused the terrorist attack, right? But then when the cycle of violence is perpetuated with what I would call another terrorist attack, like bombing Afghanistan, the people whose name that attack is done in, we're also not the ones determining the policies and the reasons behind repeating this violence. And this gets to the heart of the fact that people in the U.S. are not self-governing people. We don't have much control over a government, just like the Afghanistan people, the people in Afghanistan, do not have a lot of control over the Taliban. There's historical reasons why the U.S. government, just taking U.S. as an example, and its corporate sponsors are unresponsive to the will of the people and act in such a way as to protect the wealthiest few at the expense of the many and the expense of the environment. In 1781, the former colonies, which were now states, ratified the Articles of Confederation, which would have reserved most of the power of government for the states and had a decentralized government in large part. But then when delegates from the state legislatures met again just 6 years later at the Constitutional Convention in 1787 held in Philadelphia, suddenly the meetings held secretly. The notes aren't released for about another 53 years, and the participants were pledged to secrecy. It was behind closed doors. And between 1781 and 1787, there were a number of events which led to the way the meeting went. There were conflicts between classes that were played out with the state legislatures, and there were conflicts between classes that had given rise to armed insurrections against state governments. And the men who assembled for the Constitutional Convention were all men of property. And James Madison, for instance, the Constitution's primary author, told the convention that the greatest conflict that the country faced was the conflict between those who held property and those who didn't. The Constitution was basically designed to protect the interests of the propertied few. And in part, by removing power from the state legislatures, which had been attacking the propertied classes, and also protecting and ensuring the continuance of certain types of economic enterprise, which were favorable to the propertied class, and also by holding the Union together. It's important to recognize that at that time of the American Revolution, most people in the colonies were not considered citizens. Native Americans, in fact, were not even considered people. African Americans were considered property. Women were considered property. Debtors were considered property, even children. So while human rights were not protected in the main body of the Constitution, the obligation to return runaway slaves to the slave owners was specified in the Constitution. Only about 20% of the colonists were enfranchised citizens, and of those, the wealthiest were the ones who framed the government to protect their class interests through the Constitution. And throughout the history of the U.S., whole classes of people have had to struggle separately for their basic civil rights. There's been the African-American civil rights struggle, women's suffrage movement, and these struggles continue to today, including struggles for gays and lesbians to have recognized rights and so forth. The fatal flaw in the Revolution, where at which time all men were declared to be equal, was that there were gross inequities. And that helps explain why different activists in the U.S. have evolved with all their different issues. They're all divided by race, class, gender, and issue, all operating separately. And this has made it really easy for the corporate powers to divide and conquer us. And they tend to do this through the use of scapegoats. You see in the news, welfare mothers, they're to blame for your ills. The communists hiding under the beds. The gays and lesbians. The environmentalists. The spotted owls. Anybody but the real corporate perpetrators of the policies. And when looking at corporate abuses and corporate domination of our culture and government, it's important to recognize that corporations have not always wielded these powers. At the time of the Revolution, the revolutionists were very concerned about corporate power because of their experience with the British Crown corporations as they saw it oppressing them and preventing them from creating finished products to trade at higher value. Instead, they were required to ship raw materials to England for them to create the finished products. So there were strict limitations set upon corporations with the beginning of the new country, such as a corporation could not buy out another corporation and amass greater wealth and power. It was not allowed to lobby public officials to influence public policy. It had a certain time frame in which to exist, 5, 10, or 20 years. Basically, for instance, a papermaking corporation could only make paper. It couldn't lobby public officials. It couldn't give charitable donations to improve its public image. None of that. And even though only about 20% of the public were enfranchised citizens, those citizens did have the right to go before the state legislature and say, we believe that this corporation has exceeded its given authority given to it by the public as an instrument of the public will, and the burden of proof was on the corporation, not the individual citizen, to prove that it shouldn't be dissolved. And indeed, corporate charters were revoked and their assets were distributed, especially in the case of mergers. So anyway, this started to change because with the coming of the Civil War in particular, there was a tremendous influx of money into the economy, which wars tend to do. They started running the railroads across the country to facilitate troop movements. That created a great railroad industry. They wanted a centralized banking system, the Union did, so that the troops could spend money anywhere in the country. At that time, banking was pretty decentralized. You had to be roughly within 50 miles of the bank for your banknote to be recognized. So they created the Federal Reserve System soon thereafter and the centralized banking system. And this all put a lot of money into the corporate system, creating new corporations like grain, insurance, all this kind of thing, and also expanding the power through the banking system for the existing corporate operations. And so the corporate CEOs looked at the situation and suddenly started having grand dreams. Look at how much money we could raise. And they saw that they were limited by these charter limitations, by these restrictions placed on corporations, and by the quo warranto, literally by what authority challenges that citizens could make to their operations. So they gradually started winning for corporations the constitutional rights of citizens behind closed doors through judge-made law, and such as freedom of speech, due process, and so forth, using the Bill of Rights and the 14th Amendment. And along the way, they were conceded corporate personhood. In 1886, Santa Clara decision creating the strange concept of a corporate citizen being able to have these rights. So with corporations now setting public policy, paying for politicians, and ensuring political agendas they want are met, it's important to remember that corporations were originally devised simply as tools to serve the public welfare. And now that they've developed institutions to advance their collective agenda, like lobbying organizations, PACs, think tanks, public relations firms, and the armies and the military and police to serve them, it's really important to recognize it's an entire system of corporate governance we're talking about. So it's not enough for activists anymore to go against one corporation at a time or one abuse at a time. We need to start dismantling the system of corporate power. And that way we can get back to the point where people define once again what corporations can and can't do rather than letting corporations define us.
Oh, that's okay. My colleague,
and
Jane Ann Morris.
I'm Jane Ann Morris. I'm a member of POCLAD, and I live in Madison, Wisconsin. I'd like to go at this from a slightly different angle, and that is to start talking about something that is really in the air now, and especially, I would imagine, in Seattle, which is the issue of so-called free trade, which I'm going to stop wiggling my hands, but if I ever say that again, I mean it in quotes. And what we've seen with the World Trade Organization and with NAFTA is that essentially an unelected panel is able to play a global governance role. So I'm going to give some quick examples, and I'm not going to specify whether it's WTO or NAFTA because there are some slight differences, but I'll be saying things like an unelected world tribunal, and that would also apply to proposals for FTAA, the Free Trade Area of the Americas. You've heard about the Mexican truck controversy. The United States has some laws, some federal laws, that are about truck safety on the highways, and in order for Mexico to comply with them, it would cost them some money to do that. So what happened was that this was adjudicated under NAFTA in one of these unelected panels, and it's a mess now because it looks very much like it will be declared, if it came to that, against world free trade. So an unelected international tribunal, in this case it was NAFTA, was saying that a national law was a barrier to free trade. And they would be able to essentially put the United States in the position of either backing down on their laws or paying for the privilege of having the law, like paying a fine or a penalty to the Mexican government or to the corporation. Okay, that's a situation that a lot of people are outraged at, that an unelected international tribunal could begin to tell the United States or any other nation what law to have. But actually that situation is really pretty familiar here, because in the past in the United States, many states passed laws about truck safety on their own highways, truck length and other measures, and those state laws were declared unconstitutional by an unelected national tribunal known as the U.S. Supreme Court. In the era before that, when the states were passing laws about railroad safety in their states, the U.S. Supreme Court also used the same argument, commerce, the Interstate Commerce Clause, or free commerce as an argument to essentially invalidate state laws. There are many more examples of this. You've probably heard of the European Union beef situation, where they decided they did not want to import artificial growth hormone full beef from the United States. Okay, and you probably know the outcome of that, which was that the WTO declared that an interference with free trade. They declared that to be a trade barrier, and in fact, the European Union refused to back down, and so the United States government had the right under WTO rules to retaliate in trade against the European Union. In other words, again, an unelected international tribunal declared a national law a barrier to free trade, and the choice left was either back down on the law or pay up. Okay? This also shouldn't be new here, because in the United States there have been many laws through the years about protecting states from incoming beef or incoming livestock or incoming food. There are a number of laws having to do with Texas cattle, having to do with meat inspection and so on, that states passed to protect their citizens, and they were declared unconstitutional by our own unelected national tribunal, the U.S. Supreme Court, on Commerce Clause grounds. You may have also heard of the recent example of British Columbia and water. They essentially passed a law that said they didn't want to export water because actually a California corporation wanted to import it and sell it. That case is still pending, but essentially it's the same issue, which is an international tribunal, and it was NAFTA in this case, can essentially compel Canada to either back down on this law or to pay for the privilege of keeping this law. We have similar cases in the United States having to do with water. For example, the state of Kansas had a law against export of its water, placing severe restrictions on that. And there have been other state laws that are set up, obviously, to protect resources, and those have also been declared unconstitutional by our national unelected tribunal, the U.S. Supreme Court, on Commerce Clause grounds, which is the way they describe what we now call free trade, still in quotes. I can give you more examples. You've probably heard of Metalclad Corporation in Mexico. San Luis Potosí in Mexico repeatedly and in various ways made it clear they didn't want this corporation to build a toxic hazardous waste dump there. And the company took issue with that, and it went to NAFTA, and this one, in fact, has been finished. And, in fact, Mexico had to pay this corporation from the United States because the people of Mexico decided they didn't want a hazardous waste dump there. So international tribunal declaring a national law to be in violation of free trade, thereby forcing the country to choose between keeping the law or backing down or paying up. We have the same thing going on in this country. And I'll stop these endless examples soon, but believe me, I could go on and on. New Jersey passed laws trying to set up a waste treatment facility that would be able to withstand kind of the long-term waste that they expected, and it placed severe limits on waste from out of state. That was declared unconstitutional by the U.S. Supreme Court. Michigan tried to work out a statewide system of hazardous waste so that no county in Michigan would be taking waste from all over the country. That was declared unconstitutional by the U.S. Supreme Court. And Alabama, which has the largest commercial hazardous waste facility in the country, was trying very hard not to be the hazardous waste dump for the whole country, passed a series of laws to try and prevent this, and in fact, they were declared unconstitutional by the U.S. Supreme Court. So there's a basic parallel. Whereas with WTO and NAFTA, an international unelected tribunal is declaring national laws against free trade and thereby forcing the issue, pay or back down on your law. What we had in the case of the United States with the Commerce Clause was a national unelected tribunal, the U.S. Supreme Court, declaring state laws unconstitutional. And these laws, as you have seen, have been for things like protecting the natural resources of the state, protecting the health and safety of the people in it, or protecting the local economy. So I want to suggest to you that we already live in a free trade zone here, and we've lived in one for over 100 years, so we ought to know what it's like, and we ought to know what the arguments are going to be, and I've looked at many of the cases, and they're nearly identical. Our unelected tribunal that can make these decisions unappealable based on Commerce Clause is called the U.S. Supreme Court. It constrains us in many ways against the kinds of laws that we can pass at the state level to protect national resources, people, or the economy. People have been upset when they realize that under NAFTA, corporations can sue governments and essentially challenge their laws. Well, in this country, for at least 150 years, corporations have been able to challenge state laws, and they've done it over and over again. What we've seen, and there are hundreds of state laws that have been thrown out, is every time a state passes a law to control a corporation's activity and protect its own citizens, it puts itself in the position of being challenged by the corporations who didn't want to be regulated in that way, and the case gets sent to the federal courts, and in many, many cases, those laws have been declared unconstitutional. So, what I would like to suggest is that what's left for the states, and you see this in a lot of our own activism in which we censor ourselves, is things like we have states and municipalities regulating tavern hours, some speed limits, bow hunting deer season, and they can pick the state bird. Whereas the kind of things that used to be part of a sovereign state's ability to protect its citizens have very much gone by the wayside. So the main point I wanted to inject here tonight was simply the idea that if we did not already have a free trade area within the United States, and if we controlled the corporations that those same states create, then we wouldn't be in the situation we are today with the WTO. And so my idea is we have a lot of work to do at the home front. Now I'd like to introduce Richard Grossman. Richard Grossman, also one of the co-founders, and he'll tell you anything else you need to know.
Thank you, Jane Ann. Before I start, there is a clipboard with a piece of paper asking people who want to be on our mailing list to sign up. I hope that's moving around. And that doesn't go on my time, Ward.
We'll see.
I'd like to talk about another realm, use of the Constitution, that makes it almost impossible, makes it impossible for us at a local and state level to use our legislatures, our elected legislatures, to make the rules. It's the whole question of speech and assembly and money as speech. And it's for me, it's been fascinating to unravel how much the question of speech as it's been handled over the last 100 years or so, particularly in the courts, how the language is so much related to the kind of language that Jane Ann was just talking about trade. And it's also very relevant to what's happening today. So I'm going to make a couple of generalizations. One is, in this country's history, in time of war, every time in time of war, there's been a clampdown on people's speech. And the Supreme Court has been complicit, if not leading the charge. So that in time of war, starting in the 1790s with the Alien and Sedition Acts, it wasn't even a time of war, a time of some stress, the federal government and many states have passed laws restricting the ability of people to say dangerous things like against war, against the draft, and the like. And every time the Supreme Court has had an opportunity to affirm the right of people to speak, they blew it and sent people to jail. And the notion, which many of us were brought up with, that Oliver Wendell Holmes and some of the other justices were great pillars of free speech of the First Amendment, just turns out not to be true. Even the Warren Court, it took many years after the height of the McCarthy era in the 1950s and early 60s before the Warren Court gingerly began to deal with the legislation passed by Congress that was restrictive of people's fundamental rights. But the insidious thing was in the great dissent of Oliver Wendell Holmes, what's considered one of the great dissents in dealing with a World War I case, where somebody distributed leaflets urging people not to become men, not to become cannon fodder. The language that they used, which is now the language of discourse within the legal community, is, guess what? Free trade in ideas, the competition in the marketplace of ideas. It's not about speech in the village square. It's about one idea competing with another so that the truth will out and one idea will win. And not people, free people coming together in the village square, discussing, debating, so that, you know, interacting so that a new synthesis comes out. Not that there's one idea that wins out. So that the whole metaphor from trade and competition has taken over the language within the legal community on the First Amendment, which I think is insidious, because you win, you lose. The other half of that is, of course, that beginning after World War II, the courts began to give corporations, read the corporation into the First Amendment, to say that the corporation, this artificial entity, this property, can wield the First Amendment. And practically, what does that mean? Well, I lived for a while in the state of Massachusetts. In 1976, the state of Massachusetts passed a law and said, when there's a referendum, when people put a referendum on the ballot, corporations are restricted in their contributing money and participating in the campaign around the referendum. And what the legislature said was, when the corporations pour money into referendums, like that, it has a negative effect upon the democratic process. Not the most radical idea in the world, right? Immediately, a bunch of banking corporations took them to state court, went up to the Supreme Judicial Court of Massachusetts, and unanimously, the Supreme Court of Massachusetts upheld the law. The banks then went to federal court. It went to the United States Supreme Court. And the United States Supreme Court nullified the law of Massachusetts. And what they did was they reframed the question. Even though the state of Massachusetts had said, the legislators had said, when a giant corporations get involved in a referenda, it's bad for democracy. What they said is, in the marketplace of ideas, all speech is welcome. And all speech is necessary. All people must be allowed to speak. Corporations are people. They must be allowed to speak. This law is against the Constitution. Nullified. So what you had was what's called a private corporation, which banking corporations are, an agglomeration of property, was able to go to the federal courts to nullify a duly passed law that the people passed that survived challenge in the state judicial Supreme Court. That's private power using the First Amendment to prevent people from making the rules in their own community. Similar thing happened in Vermont. The people of Vermont passed a state law, again, not the most radical in history, calling for all foods containing bovine growth hormone, RBGH, to be labeled. You know, not the most radical law in the history of the world. They went to the federal courts, and the federal judges said, there's a concept called negative free speech. You cannot be compelled to say what you don't want to say if you're a person. The corporation is a person. If it doesn't want a label, it doesn't have to. The law is thrown out. And then just recently, last year, the Massachusetts passed another law banning the tobacco corporations from advertising their products within 1,000 feet of a school. Not the most radical law in history. right to federal court and started yelling, free speech, free speech, our First Amendment rights. And the Supreme Court in June of 2000, unanimously, 9-0, nullified the law of the people of Massachusetts. Again, we have many lists, every state, communities, localities, a city council could pass a law, the same thing happens. And we've only dealt with the Commerce Clause and the First Amendment. We haven't talked about the other amendments that they use against us, the Contracts Clause and other aspects of it. So not only has sort of the language of free speech and First Amendment been perverted by encapsulation in the metaphor of trade and competition, this pernicious doctrine. But in fact, the Supreme Court, these appointed people, have the authority to overrule the laws that we pass in our communities, that we try to make the rules for how we're going to live. All to say is, through many, many more examples, 200 years of history and things unfolding, the essential decisions that define our lives, that define life and death, that define the work that we do, that shape our communities, you know, that define what poison's in the air and what poison's in the water, are literally beyond the people's authority. This market, not the marketplace of ideas, but the market is a structure in which we are forbidden to tread. Because investment decisions by corporations, technology decisions by corporations, the organization of work decisions by corporations are considered under the law and culture of this country as private and beyond our authority. Maybe we can regulate them a little around the edges, fight over 50 parts per million of a poison is acceptable to be emitted, or 45 parts per million as a poison is acceptable. But here's what I want to leave you with, is that the fundamental decision-making that define our lives and define our community, define life and death, define war and peace, have been defined as beyond our authority, as private, and is shielded by the Constitution, shielded by the courts, our own Constitution being used against us. And unless, in all the organizing and educating that we do, we understand how that works, and we challenge it as we try to stop the particular assault. If we don't do that, then we're opening ourselves up to be in the same boat time after time after time. It's we who have to change, not the corporations. We have to change how we think, what we know, and what we do. Thank you.
You were just listening to four speakers from Hope Lab, taped at the University of Washington last month. Thanks so much to Mike McCormick for providing that tape.
If you have an event you'd like us to announce or an issue you'd like us to cover on the program, you can contact us at our website at www.radioforall.org/unwelcome. That's radio, the number 4, ALL.org/unwelcome. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Unwelcome Guests is produced by Chris Sturr, Jesse Lind, Lynn Gary, and Sean Ewald. We are solely responsible for its content.
Catch me napping one day and they'll kill me. Then I'll be gone, but that won't be my end. For my guns and my saddle will all